Hello and welcome to the Green Room Golf Course podcast from the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association. Thanks for listening to this podcast, which sheds a light upon the golf industry and what it takes to maintain a modern course. Don't forget, if you're a golfer and you've got any questions about anything you hear on the podcast, have a conversation with the greenkeepers at your club. They've got the expertise to explain what's happening at the course and how it fits into the team's long-term vision to improve playability and enjoyment of the facility. I hope you enjoy the show. Welcome to this week's episode. And before we get started, I wanted to give a shout out to the team up at Dunstan Macassel, who are coming to terms with the loss of their greenkeeping facility and all their equipment following a serious fire. Podcast fans may be familiar with Dunstan Macassel and its course manager Stuart Imerson, as he hosts the Turfs Up podcast alongside Annex Jack Hetherington. There may be a rival podcast, I just want to say, but I promise I had nothing to do with it. I spoke to Stuart last week and he told me about all the help and support they've received the last few weeks since the fire. It's absolutely brilliant that the association, the greenkeeping industry and even the golf industry can come together and help each other when times get hard. Another example of that is the Bigger Benevolent Fund, and we're delighted that this year Nick Miles and the team at Chesterfield have offered to host a charity golf day to support the fund. You can find details in the latest edition of Greenkeeper International and on our website. The United States Golf Association, you'll know it as the USGA, is the governing body for golf in the United States and Mexico. They work alongside the RNA to administer golf, including producing and interpreting the rules of the sport. The USGA conducts the US Open, the US Women's Open and 12 other championships. But for golfers and greenkeepers in the UK, it's probably through their famous and fabled USGA greens that you'll have come into contact with them. USGA specification putting greens have been the standard bearer for greens construction for nearly 60 years, and you'll proudly hear of golf clubs advertising that they have USGA spec greens while others have to make do with simple push-ups. If you're interested in learning more about the different types of putting green construction, by the way, I'd urge you to speak to your greenkeeping team to find out more. In 2018, the specifications for USGA standard greens construction were revised, and we were fortunate that at Continue to Learn 2019, USGA agronomist Elliot Dowling delivered a series of workshops to bigger members. Elliot's the former course superintendent at Crest Creek and the Ivanhoe in Illinois, and he undertakes course visits, educational outreach, and conducts research throughout the region on behalf of the USGA, so he's the ideal person to talk to. While in Harrogate, I took the opportunity to speak to Elliot about the work of the USGA and whether he thinks the method of greens construction is still as influential today as it was in the past. We also spoke about the contrast between American and European greenkeeping, and it's fantastic to gain an insight into the intricacies of the golf industry from the other side of the Atlantic. I hope you enjoy the listen.
The USGA prides itself in its USGA recommendations for putting Absolutely. Reconstruction, and something that we just revisited and revised last year, and so it's fresh on everybody's mind. And
oh, that's funny. That's one of my questions, actually, is
yeah,
you know, whether it's because it's been around 60 years, actually.
Right.
And that sort of sense of one of the things you touched upon is getting a different greenkeeping culture, you know, looking at different cultures. So how the UK greenkeeping differs from the US greenkeeping.
Certainly.
There is big differences, but that means we can learn across the board.
I agree, and that's actually something I'm really interested in my time over here, is trying to absorb as much of that. Because honestly, you know, this is, as we said, my first time here to this conference, and so my exposure to European greenkeeping is probably a lot of European greenkeepers' exposure to American. It's what I see on TV and yeah. what I hear, right?
Yeah.
And then you got to kind of discern what you hear. Is it fact or a okay. fishtail?
So your first time over here for this, what's the reputation, be honest, what's yeah. the reputation of UK greenkeepers over in America?
You know, I think it's still, everybody has the reputation or in their mind that it's more of a minimalistic approach.
Yeah.
And I don't know that that's right or wrong. I haven't seen every golf course. Obviously we see the Open mm-hmm. championship on TV, and And those seem to be very distinct golf courses in the links style that they are. I have to believe there are some golf courses with trees over here somewhere, more Parkland style like you'd find in the States. But we are certainly into manicuring golf courses, right? I mean, they're really manicured heavily. Yeah. And I think for a lot of reasons, we're actually getting away from that. Now, I wouldn't say we're heading down the European path, and a lot of it just comes down to our golf courses compared to yours in terms of architecture and design. But we are trying to not manicure as much.
Yeah.
And some of that, we're looking over here
yeah.
and saying, how, you know, they're producing really good playing conditions, championship level conditions, and in some ways doing it differently than us. And there's a lot that goes into this, as you know. I mean, it's not a simple formula. But we are trying to ease the burden on some of these maintenance requirements for American superintendents.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because what the reputation our guys looking at over there is that it's, you know, you've got £1 million budgets, £1 million on fertilizer, £1 million on that sort of thing.
Yeah. And interestingly, since the recession in 08, 09, you know, budgets really came down during that period and have come back up slightly.
Uh-huh.
I don't know that they'll ever get back to where we were. We were just such a heyday, that late 90s, early 2000s, I mean, when Tiger Woods was booming and golf was really booming in the States, and people were investing.
Yep.
And then the recession, that got everybody scared, rightfully so. And so we're creeping back into the budgets, but I think we're really learning some valuable lessons that golf course superintendents and their staffs are still producing the same conditions, in a lot of respects, better conditions.
Right.
Without as much money. And a lot of it comes down to they're not spending as much time on, you know, what I'd say the outside the rope, some of the, you know, mulch beds and bushes and accessories. They're really focusing on playability. And for a lot of people, when the budget came down, if you spend money on water, you know, we have a lot of golf courses in the States that pay for water. They just couldn't pay for as much water. So you're, in effect, running the golf course drier than you were before. For some people, it means that they're accepting a little bit more discoloration in the name of playability.
Yeah.
But golfers of all age categories, of all abilities, doesn't matter your gender, they're really enjoying this extra carry of the ball with a drier golf course. Whereas before, I think we were so focused on green, lush, manicured, that in a lot of respects, they were being overwatered. And we're learning now that we didn't need to do that.
Yeah, we call it so. Running golf rather than target golf, right?
Right.
You get that phrase. So does the, when you guys look over and you see the links, you see the open, and you see that's brown, does that help you in that?
Well, it doesn't hurt. I mean, I think it helps when people see championship level golf courses that look like this.
Uh-huh.
But we also know that weather and grasses are different and really just your sandy soils compared to our heavy kind of farmland soils in a lot of regions.
Yeah.
So at least for now, I'm confident golf courses aren't going to go all in on that, especially if you're used to that green Parkland style. I mean, just the differences in architecture wouldn't lend itself to that.
Yeah, it comes.
But I think we're leaning down the path. We're heading down the path of we can be a little bit off color at times. The grass is still healthy, and the playability is really good. The ball's running. And for a lot of these older golf courses, classic era in the United States, they were really designed more for that bump and run ground game. You look at the classic architects, and we got away from that with these over manicured. And so you took, again, classic architecture, you know, Donald Ross, Rayner, McKenzie, these guys, and you transformed even their golf course by making it more of an aerial assault versus a bump and run. And golfers now are commenting that they're really enjoying how interesting golf courses, these classic courses are again, because they are drier and we're able to run the ball around and you bring in some interesting features that these architects always wanted you to play into.
Absolutely, yeah.
You just didn't have that option.
Some of the rule changes that have just come in from golf, they're talking like you can move debris out the bunker, that sort of thing, as you would, and there's a rule change, isn't it, that you can remove your ball if it's plugged and that's on the fairway and that sort of thing. Is that a recognition of the sort of the changing of that, what you were talking about, how perhaps it won't be as pristine, that there might be bits? Is that an understanding?
Yeah, so there were several reasons why some of these rules changes were made. Yeah. And obviously the USGA and the RNA partnered together in this. And a lot of it comes down to, and I don't hit on the rules too much in my golfer enjoyment presentation, but a lot of it is golfer enjoyment and pace of play. I mean, golfers in the States certainly have clearly told us that they don't have the time, nor do they want to play a five-hour round or a six-hour round of golf. They really want 4 hours or less. And that's always kind of been the mantra, but just the way some of the golf courses are designed or laid out, you couldn't do it. We're losing golfers, or we're not attracting golfers that are clearly telling us what they want. And so a lot of these rules changes are geared towards just trying to make your day a little bit more enjoyable and quick. You know, play it as quickly as you want to at your pace, right? And not have to be so burdened by some of these rules. And that's been the feedback that we're getting. Our people are enjoying some of these things that seem to pick up a little bit of time. You're not going to go from a five-hour round to a three-hour round because of them, but if you can pick up some time, that's going to make more people happy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. One of the things is the you just have 3 minutes to set you a ball rather than five, like, which suggests to me that you would be asking the greenkeepers to cut the rough a little bit lower so guys can find the ball quicker. But that sort of flies in the face of that sort of outside the ropes. You know, you were talking about inside the ropes greenkeeping.
Right.
That sort of flies in the face of that a little bit. Would you agree?
No, we're not asking people to cut that down. In fact, we're asking people to plant more of that. And you mentioned wildflowers.
Yeah.
There's a monarch initiative, the monarch butterfly.
Yeah.
And a lot of that, the way they fly through kind of central United States up through the East Coast.
Yeah.
We're really asking people to plant more wildflowers, plant more milkweed, to bring in more habitat. So at least with that rule in particular, or that question, no, we're not asking them to eliminate these. In fact, we'd like to see more of it, reduce resources as much as possible.
So you touched upon the USGA spec greens and that sort of thing. My question for you is, that's 60 years old now, isn't it? Is that still relevant for the modern world? Does it need updating?
Well, I think it's very relevant for the modern world, and we updated it last year.
Yeah.
Really, if you look at our original specifications, the very first that came out compared to where we sit today, in a lot of ways it's the exact same. The construction, the design, the principles, the research are really the same with just a lot of refinements. Mm-hmm. And with this last revision, we've added a couple different testing techniques in terms to find suitable gravel, to find suitable mixes. But a lot of it came down to just better clarification. Superintendents all over, of all abilities, really, are really getting deep into putting green construction. When their time comes, when their golf course has decided they're going to rebuild one green or all of their greens, they're really getting good at making mixes just for their golf course.
Yeah.
Whether they want to hold a little bit more moisture or be really dry, really firm, whatever they're looking for. And so in a lot of the ways, we revise the revisions or revise the guidelines so that it better explains how they go about testing and creating their mix that's perfect for their property.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of it's just clarification and education, really.
Yeah.
You know, we want to help everybody. As a golf course consultant, when I go on a CCS visit and someone wants help modifying their putting green one way or the other, we want to help them. You know, we want to be that authority for them. But we still couldn't stand by, if you really want to rebuild your putting greens, and let's say you have kind of the native clay soil right now and you want a higher performance putting green, spend the money and do it right and get the drainage, get the gravel, and build a USGA green.
Okay.
Otherwise, you're talking, you know, a modified soil green, which a lot of people have. And a lot of that came from years of top dressing and aeration and just sand incorporation. And those perform really well. But if you really do want to rebuild a green for high performance, I'd try to talk you into rebuilding the green.
It's still the best way to do it.
It's still the best way to do it.
Yeah. The RNA and other bodies, they're adapting to suit the modern game, that sort of thing. Golf Course 2030, Golf Links, they're both RNA schemes. What's the USGA? What are your priorities for the coming years and going forwards?
Well, in terms of just the green section where I work, we're really focused on reducing resources, getting golf courses to ease the burden on superintendents to have these ultra-perfect golf courses and focus more on what really matters, getting your fairways, your tees, your greens where you want them. Mm-hmm. You know, with whatever budget you're given, let's make that money work the best for us, right, for your facility.
Yeah.
And then trying to get rid of, as we talked about, some of those outside the ropes, you know, having manicured rough everywhere. You know, can you put in some fine fescue naturalized rough, some reduced maintenance rough? Perhaps it is wildflowers, milkweed, something to bring in more wildlife, some more habitat. But we're really focused on reducing water consumption. I mean, that's just, in the United States, that's a very real concern and a very real issue.
Yeah.
Is water is becoming a high priority for golf courses. And how do you reduce your reliance on water? And then how do you reduce your reliance on basically everything else on top of that? Fuel consumption, fertilizer use, pesticide use. And a lot of that, honestly, is being driven by just where we are in golf right now in the States. It's really difficult to find labor. Turf schools don't have as many students as they've had in the past.
Yep.
And so golf course superintendents and their staff just can't do as much as they used to, even if they wanted to. They don't have as many people. So then you start to prioritize what's most important. For us, in most golf courses, it's always going to be tee green fairway is where you're going to sink most of your money.
Yep.
And then you look outside of that with what you have left.
Do you work with that side of thing to try and increase the attractiveness of the career, you know, a career in golf?
Yeah, of course. And it's, you know, we don't do it so much with superintendents because they're in it, right? I mean, hopefully if they're in it, they enjoy it and we don't need to convince them of it. And assistants, a lot of ways the same. But I know myself and most of the other agronomists, you know, we'll speak at turf clubs at universities. We'll sort, you know, speak at conferences where there are students there.
Yeah.
But we really try to get people into this business because it's still a good business. You know, I got into it. I was a superintendent before I joined the USGA. And you can make a good living. You can have a good career. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of ways, you can get what you want on both sides. I think a lot of the students coming out of school now, they value that work-life balance heavily. You know, they want to be at work when they need to be at work, but they also want to be away from work with their family, their kids, whomever. And that really is a priority to them. And so kind of reshaping the job a little bit where obviously you need to meet stakeholder expectations, whoever that is that's paying the bills. You need to meet those expectations. But you have to be there all the time, like kind of the older generation still does or thinks you do. And that, in a lot of ways, is turning some of these younger people away. But as we grow and learn, we're realizing that you can kind of have it both ways. And that's the important part for a lot of the students now, is realizing that you can do this job and have a life outside of this job.
Yeah, you brought to mind a course visit I did a couple of months ago where it's a farmer who owns the course, so he's not your traditional greenkeeper. He doesn't have that tradition of the members' own club and that sort of thing. And he lets his guys come in for work at 8 o'clock, which I wonder if it's as simple as that. If you're a student and you're looking at greenkeeping as a career and you're thinking, I don't want to get up at 5 a.m. to get into work, but 8 o'clock is quite reasonable. Whether a simple change like that?
Well, you know, I'm going to say it could be for some people, but you still keep in mind at 8 o'clock, at least in the States, golf courses have been open in the summer for at least a half an hour, if not more.
Yeah.
So, you know, you need some management team there.
Absolutely.
But to that point, if you're a golf course with one or two assistants, you know, a bigger golf course with multiple layers of management, in that situation it could work, mm-hmm. where you give people a morning to sleep in, so to speak, although they probably wouldn't when you're used to waking up so early anyway, you just get up, but you know, morning to do laundry perhaps. Or so there are creative ways that people are making this job more enticing. I think a good one that I've seen a few courses start to do is when they post for a job, they don't post the job saying it, you know, it's from 5:30 in the morning to 3 or 3:30 in the afternoon, kind of a hard start and stop time.
Yeah,
they're saying, you tell us when you think you can work and we'll make that work for us,
yeah.
you know, within reason, of course. But, you know, there are a lot of people, laborers on golf courses that have a morning job or an evening job. So they say, well, I can't be there at 5:30 in the morning, but I can be there at noon and I can work till 5. Okay, fine. Come at noon and work till 5. And, you know, on a golf course, and I would imagine it's the same here, there's always something to be done.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you could literally work 24 hours a day if you wanted to. The grass mm-hmm. grows all the time. So people are getting creative with staggering. You know we need X people in the morning to get greens cut and rough cut or whatever, bunkers raked. And then you can kind of filter in and out in the afternoon to continue to mow rough or, you know, change whatever. And people are whether they like it or not, they're being forced down that path anyway, because that's just the reality of the labor pool right now.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's the subtext, isn't it? I suppose if somebody says they can work, then are you really in a position to turn them away just because it might not be the exact hours?
A lot of people aren't in a position to turn them away. They really need somebody whenever they can come.
Yeah, absolutely.
Proper jealous of the person that's going to win it this year, because I'd love to go back and do it again. It was just one of them experiences that I'll never forget. It was amazing, it really was amazing.
Got a promotion after winning the awards to first assistant, so taking a lot in this year. I've been told quite a few times to get better, which is it's helped me a lot. The guys around me at work have been brilliant, just the environment I need. So really winning this award has been a huge step in the right direction for me.
What we're looking for, and what the Student Greenkeeper of the Year is actually looking for, is to really kind of find out what knowledge you've gained while you've been studying for your level 2s and level 3s, and also what practical experience you gained and how you're kind of applying those in your everyday work practices. The one thing I really enjoy about the final is just everybody coming together. The young greenkeepers in the main award, they mix together, they discuss what they've been doing at their golf clubs and what they've been learning, and they generally leave here with some really firm friendships that they take back into the industry.
We're pleased to say that the partnership between Bigger, Resync and the Toro Company in the Toro Student Greenkeeper of the Year Award from its inception was about promoting greenkeeping as a career through education and continuous learning. That legacy has become apparent through the worthy names of winners over the past 30 years and the mark they've made on the industry that they work in.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Bigger House for the 30th Toro Student Greenkeeper of the Year final. The 2018 Young Toro Student Greenkeeper of the Year award goes to Danny Patton from Lee Park Golf Club. Of the Toro 2018 Toro Student of the Year Award with a prize of an 8-week trip to the USA with a 6-week residential course at University of Massachusetts, trip to GIS and a trip to Toro's factory in Minneapolis is Daniel Ashelby from Wilson Golf.
Right, leading up to the announcement, I just felt very calm, and then when they said it, my heart started going a bit then. It was a bit crazy. I didn't know what to expect when I arrived. I thought I'd be walking into probably like 6 master greenkeepers, you walk into people at the same level. They're, just a very passionate people, very dedicated people as well.
I was more excited to kind of show off what I know to the likes of Chris and Stuart, Chris Kennedy, Matt Pegner, Wentworth, massive and bigger. So to share my knowledge with him, see if he approves, just like kind of says, alright, I'm doing something right here. Just the fact that they give the time up for 2 days and here to see who's going to progress, who's got the most passion and who contributes the most to Bigger, and they give the contribution back, which is just even better. That's why Bigger is so unique and so good. You can speak to greenkeepers like this, so it's fantastic. Yeah.
You've mentioned about the aims of the USGA and that sort of thing. How can greenkeepers help you achieve those aims? Is it are you encouraging greenkeepers to communicate more with their members about what can be achieved, or is there anything else they can do to really help you guys out?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think a lot of it at least starts with communication. Mm-hmm. It's going to, again, your stakeholders, whomever they are, and saying, here's our budget as it is right now, and we're making it work. However, if we didn't have to water the rough as much, or if we didn't have to mow the fairways as much, or rake the bunkers every day, if we could adjust how we do some things, we could take that same pool of money and put it more into something. You know, you want something more done to the putting greens, fine. We can find that money within our budget. So there are a lot of ways superintendents can help themselves and help the industry, and it does definitely start with communication up top and saying, we need to make our money work as smart as possible for us.
Yeah.
And if you're right now, call it wasting on some of these, you know, outside the rope hazard areas, accessories, you know, a lot of trees on golf courses.
Yeah.
You know, what can we do to reduce that burden?
Yeah. We're very much along the same lines of communication, along the same message, that exact same message. Only I wonder, over here, we're almost used to that sort of thing already. Do you think it'd be harder in the States to deliver that message, because golfers over there really do expect almost perfection, don't they?
They do. That's still, I think, probably the biggest or top couple biggest hurdles we still face is, I think golfers are becoming more accepting of where budgets are and the reality of the situation. And I think they're becoming more accepting of the fact that superintendents need to do some things differently. But at the end of the day, it's still difficult for them to wrap their head totally around the fact that the rough might not get cut every day, or the bunkers might not get raked every day. I mean, that's, to say it is one thing, but then to do it is still a fight, a challenge in the States, just because of perfection has been the name of the game for years.
We mentioned the USGA spec greens, that's the headline thing, but you guys pump millions and millions into research each, well, I'm going to say each year you pump millions,
yes.
But you put a lot of money into research.
Yes.
What else are you working on in terms of the research? Is there anything else that we should look out for?
You know, a lot of our research comes into more sustainable grass types.
Uh-huh.
We're always looking for, you know, grasses that grow better in any given area. And by better, I mean, again, less water, less fertilizer, less pesticide. I think, you know, in my area, the Northeast region, one of the best grasses to come out in the last several years has been Latitude 36 Bermuda grass. So it's a cold, hardy Bermuda grass, warm season grass. But we now have it into the Philadelphia area, really the kind of the northern edge of the transition zone.
Yeah.
And we have common Bermuda in the rough. You can find Bermuda grass, but to have now a high performance fairway, teeing surface, practice tee grass is exciting for us. So we're looking at the country as a whole, every region, and trying to identify, you know, better grasses, more sustainable grasses that use, again, less water, less fertilizer, less pesticides.
All right. I was just wondering whether the case for as these species develop, Bermuda grass, maybe that'd be something that could be introduced over here. Traditionally, it's a warm season grass, and you just wouldn't see it. But, you know, as technology changes.
Really. Yeah, I think that's the key is we're getting, I say we, the plant breeders, are getting so good at what they do. Right now, I'm of the opinion that I wouldn't say no to anything in the future. You know, to say that it wouldn't come over here, I think it probably could someday, because there were people that didn't think it was going to be in Philadelphia or further north, which it is, Bermuda grass, and doing well. And that's just going to keep getting better every year.
What's the feature of it that makes it successful?
It's really, from a playability perspective, it looks a lot like bent grass. I mean, when you stand on it and you put them side by side, it's really difficult to tell. And really, golfers can't really tell unless they get down and dig around, which during the course of a round, you're likely not doing. So as you play your round of golf and just walk over it and play over it, it's difficult to distinguish bent from Bermuda. And then a major advantage for golf course managers is it's a warm season grass. So when you're busiest, May through September or October, this grass is at its peak.
Yeah.
Whereas the alternative is bent grass, cool season grass, that even the better grasses we have that are certainly much better in terms of traffic tolerance and how much water they need, there's still a cool season grass in a really hot, humid climate. Mm-hmm. They're going to be more prone to decline, whereas all warm season grasses are just going to get stronger. Every day it gets hotter.
It's incredible what goes into grass species. As a golfer, it doesn't even cross your mind, does it?
No, it doesn't. It's been interesting. We've written a couple articles on it in the last few years, and we talk about it a lot on just visits. I think a lot of golfers, and rightfully so, they don't need to worry about the science behind it as much. So a lot of them, you know, they look at the grass and think it's grass, right? I have grass in my yard. We've got it on the golf course. They're probably about the same.
Yeah.
And they just, they don't know how many years and millions of dollars went into that one grass. And we have a lot of those grasses on the market.
Yeah. I had a, on our Facebook page, on the bigger Facebook page, I posted a piece about the change in grass and how the droughts affected the thing and diseases and that sort of thing. And one of the Facebook comments that I received was, how come I can go down to the park, or how can I can go down to the into my garden, and I don't see those diseases.
Right.
There's a real
disconnect there.
Disconnect, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, that gets back to the kind of the grass is grass mentality. And again, I think golfers are, just because science and technology is getting better, and really with technology means smartphones, right? And whether you like it or not, people can Google anything. And a lot of times they come up with misinformation, but a lot of times they come up with really good information. So people are just, they're armed, I think, with better information than they were. But no, we fight that all the time. And in particular in a difficult summer, whether it's really hot, really wet, you know, one extreme, one way or the other, really dry. When you have, let's say, a home lawn that's cut once a week at 3 inches or so, and automatic irrigation, no traffic, I mean, nothing like a golf course would have, it looks pretty good. But then when you take grass and you cut it at a tenth of an inch, and you don't water it, and you don't fertilize it, and you put a bunch of golf carts or golf traffic on it, it's going to be inherently weak. And then you put weather extremes on it, and that's the difference.
What are the sort of chemicals? Over here, we're constantly getting chemicals banned. We're going towards having no chemicals available, and that's the case for many different things. Leather jackets, chafer grubs, there's no chemical on the market that's available. I get a bit of news across in the States, and I hear about new products being launched. What's the state of the chemical industry that's over there?
You know, to me, I look at the state and say it's still really strong. We are releasing some really good products, and by really good, I mean their use rate is ultra low.
Yeah.
You know, an ounce per acre or something like that. I mean, a really low use rate. So you're getting a very effective product at a really low use rate, which is going to be better for the environment.
Yeah.
It's going to be better on your budget. You're not using as much of it. But whether it's, you know, phosphorus or some of the pesticides, insecticides, there is fear in the States of some of these going away. And there's already talk of it. I think we're battling out a few right now.
Yeah. Is the fear that, are they being banned yet, or is that for the future?
They are looking to be banned in the future.
Yeah.
Now, there are certainly states. There are states in the United States that are, you know, phosphorus-free. Your fertilizer can't contain phosphorus unless you, your soil test suggests that you need it.
Yeah.
But we have a couple insecticides, even a fungicide that they're looking to ban, and it's really scaring golf course superintendents because a lot of them are some of the most effective and most cost effective.
Yeah.
And if we lose those, what's the alternative? And I think there are other products that can be used, but they're going to come at a premium price. And not every golf course has a really big budget. Some are doing what they can with what they have.
Yeah.
And the fear of losing some of these really well-priced products that are effective is scary.
Yeah. So are you encouraging, might not be our role, but is the industry over there encouraging greenkeepers to look towards the EU and that sort of thing, whether, you know, to learn the lessons that those guys have had to come to terms?
Yeah, I don't know how much they're looking over here as much as I think the superintendents and the regional golf course superintendent chapters are really doing a good job of getting involved with their state, local, regional legislature and you know, showing them the facts.
Okay.
Right, because you get the one side of the science, but then here's the other side of the science, and really just trying to bring everything to light.
Okay.
So I see a lot of superintendents that didn't think they'd get into this role to be politicians, and it have really turned into pretty crafty politicians.
Yeah. I'm with you. I understand that point. The RNA have just launched Golf Course 2030, their vision for the future. In your opinion, what does the golf course of 2030 look like? Over in the States?
Well, I don't know that I have a dollar figure, but I'm confident it's going to have to shrink, at least at a lot of facilities.
Yeah.
You know, in the States, and I would imagine it's the same here, we have a wide range of golf facilities, from very high-end to, you know, community golf courses.
Absolutely.
And there are more people playing golf in that mid-range, public or private, down towards the community than there are the high-end anymore. Yeah. And people need to start paying attention to that, golf courses, and recognizing that, again, we take surveys. The NGF takes surveys. GCSAA takes surveys. Golfers are telling you what they're looking for. Faster round, cheaper round, more relaxed round of golf. Now it's up to the facilities to take that to heart. They need to start reading these surveys and recognize that this is the future. At least it's the future right now. Yeah. Whether you like it or not, this is who your golfers are telling you they want to be. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to get on board with that.
The Green Room Golf Course podcast is produced by myself, Carl Hansel, on behalf of the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association. For questions, comments and concerns, you can get in touch with me by emailing carl@bigger.co.uk. That's Carl with a K. You can also get in touch via social media using @biggerlimited on Twitter. And we've also got a Facebook page where all the latest notices, news releases and information from Bigger can be found. We're also on Instagram using @bigger_HQ. Subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. The more people know about the sports turf industry, the more understanding they will have about the hard work of Bigger members and other greenkeepers. If you'd like to get in contact about any other aspect of your Bigger membership, including member benefits, support or learning and development, call 01347 833 800 or email info@bigger.co.uk. You can also get more information about Bigger and how it can improve your career and your course by heading to www.bigger.org.uk.